Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Daniel Ellsberg, a former U.S. Defense Department analyst, prosecuted for his release of the now famous Pentagon Papers, who assesses recently retired counterterrorism chief Richard Clark's public criticism of the Bush administration's policies before and after the September 11th attacks. Phyllis Bennis of the Institute for Policy Studies, who examines the repercussions that could result from the Israeli government assassination of Hamas spiritual leader Sheikh Ahmed Yassin. And Dr. Kelly Brownell, director of the Yale University Center for Eating and Weight Disorders, who discusses public policy initiatives that he says could reverse America's obesity crisis. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
In the wake of the 9/11 terrorist attack, the U.S. government invested in a new Manhattan project by pumping $10 billion into biodefense research projects. In the process, the Pentagon doubled the budget for chemical and biological defense projects, and high-security nuclear weapons labs started genetic research into dangerous pathogens. According to Mother Jones magazine, a growing number of microbiologists, non-proliferation experts, and former government officials worry that the program is out of control, with U.S. scientists creating the next generation of killer germs. A report last fall by the National Academy of Sciences warned that the U.S. government doesn't have the means to prevent the misuse of this technology. The same data that can be used to treat disease can be diverted to create new pathogens designed to evade existing treatments or target specific populations. Already, Mark Buller, a U.S. virus expert, has announced that he is working to create a new deadly form of mousepox related to smallpox and planning to work on cowpox that can infect humans. Ed Hammond, a critic of the biodefense program, says that if this research were being carried out in a Chinese, Russian, or Iranian lab, this work might be seen as the smoking gun of a biowarfare program. 25 years ago, on March 28, 1979, the U.S. experienced its worst nuclear accident at the Three Mile Island nuclear complex near Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. At the time, residents near the plant fled as the cooling system in TMI Unit 2 malfunctioned, which could have led to a meltdown of the plant's nuclear core. The TMI accident badly damaged the reputation of the nuclear power industry, which during the 1950s was promoted as too cheap to meter. Over the last 30 years, questions of safety and exploding cost prevented the nuclear industry from growing beyond the 103 plants that were ordered in the mid-1970s. According to The Nation magazine, the nuclear industry survived by launching a slick media campaign that said that nuclear power was cleaner than coal and did not contribute to global warming. While Wall Street has shunned nuclear power, the industry's friends in Washington, D.C. have helped out. An early Bush-Cheney energy plan proposed building 1,000 nuclear plants by the year 2020, opening an average of one nuclear plant a week. But fears of terrorism after September 11th has again put the nuclear industry on the defensive. But the Bush administration has invented another bailout for the nuclear industry. They have proposed building a $1.1 billion reactor to manufacture hydrogen, the ultimate alternative fuel. Critics call the scheme unproven and absurd. The Nuclear Information and Resource Service notes that wind energy would be a much cheaper means of producing hydrogen. The Fox News Channel likes to boast that it's number one in cable news, but is it? For 2 years, Fox has won the race for average Nielsen ratings, the number of viewers a station has for a typical minute. Fox wins this rating race because Fox viewers tune in for longer periods of time and wins the evening contest of talk shows featuring right-wing commentators Bill O'Reilly and Sean Hannity. In contrast, the typical CNN viewer tunes in for shorter periods, getting caught up on the latest news. According to the Media Watch Group, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, the ratings game flips upside down when Nielsen's cumulative totals of viewers are considered. The cumulative figures estimate the total number of viewers watching a channel for at least 6 minutes in a given day. During the peak of the fighting in Iraq last April, CNN beat Fox in cumulative ratings, 105 million viewers to 86 million. Major advertisers pay attention to the cumulative ratings because they are eager to reach greater numbers of viewers. The CNN audience is younger, busier, and has more spendable income. Last year, CNN made $200 million more in profits than Fox. As media analyst Larry Blasius observed, there is no question in the quality of journalism. CNN is light years ahead on objectivity, and he doesn't think Fox's tabloid newspaper approach appeals to the most desirable customers. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Zelfia Hunter.
In testimony before the commission investigating the September 11th attacks on New York and Washington, former counterterrorism chief Richard Clark charged that the Bush administration failed to recognize the urgent threat posed by al-Qaeda before 9/11 and manipulated America into fighting an unprovoked war against Iraq. Since giving his damaging testimony and the release of his book Against All Enemies, Clark's credibility has been attacked by the White House and its allies as an opportunist looking for work in a future Democratic administration and an inconsistent, untrustworthy figure trying to sell his new book. But Clark, who served under Ronald Reagan, the first Bush White House, Bill Clinton, and the current administration, says that his detractors are engaged in character assassination rather than dealing with the substance of his criticism. The stakes are high in this election year, with many observers predicting that White House attacks on Mr. Clark will only further weaken Mr. Bush. Daniel Ellsberg was a career U.S. government political analyst when in 1971 he leaked the now-famous Pentagon Papers to the press. The 47-volume Defense Department internal study of the U.S. role in Southeast Asian conflicts over 3 decades was classified top secret. The documents chronicle the lies and deceit employed by government officials to justify U.S. military intervention in the region's wars. Mr. Ellsberg, originally a strong supporter of the Vietnam War, became a committed opponent and faced felony charges that could have put him in prison for 115 years. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Daniel Ellsberg, who assesses the significance of Richard Clark's testimony and the damage to Mr. Bush's presidency that could result.
Well, it's very understandable why the White House is in a panic here of trying to discredit Mr. Clark because his revelations are devastating. He's done something almost unprecedented here. I think it may well be unprecedented, not only in this country, but perhaps any country. And that is to reveal, in the form of a memoir, devastating information about the incompetence and deceptions and apathy and in ways that cost many lives, of his own colleagues and superiors, including the president, in the very term in which the book is published. People have revealed memoirs before, usually very cautious about criticizing their former bosses of either party, but normally many years later. And in this case, it's coming right at a time when it not only affects the policies and the people who are still in office, but during an election year, when it has very great bearing, it's extremely relevant and timely, but it could have the maximum effect of actually removing his boss from power, making him actually accountable in a way that would, in the ordinary course of things, not be possible simply because the public would not have the information on which to act.
Of the two major charges that Richard Clark has leveled at the White House, one being they were not taking seriously and urgently the threat of terrorism from al-Qaeda, and number two, that they really scattered and diffused the war against al-Qaeda by turning instead to declare war against Saddam Hussein in Iraq. Of those two, which do you think is more damaging to the White House as they face their reelection campaign?
They're both pretty damaging. Of course, Bush, he admitted to Bob Woodward at least a year ago that he had not had a sense of urgency about bin Laden, and he could imply that that was because the intelligence wasn't clear enough, although it's now clear that his counterterrorism chief was pushing that day by day, practically. It's true also that it wasn't getting to Bush, it would seem, but that was the fault of the intervening level, apparently Condi Rice in particular. I think that the second point, which has to do with how he reacted to the challenge once it was unmistakable with the downing of the two World Trade Center towers, the question then of what did he do then is probably more spectacular in a way, or more relevant even to the question, because his basis for re-election very largely is on the grounds of his having taken a very tough and presumably appropriate action after the towers were hit. And that's exactly what Clark is refuting in a very devastating way, which is being confirmed by many other people at the time, namely that he went in an entirely wrong direction. Tough, yes, but against the wrong people, against the wrong target. I think Clark gives a very telling analogy, which seems pretty appropriate. He says, it's as if we'd invaded Mexico after the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor. Very similar to that. And you could criticize that not only as a distraction from the real threat and a diversion of resources and attention from then on, which seems to have been true, very costly in our effectiveness against terror, that he was not just diverting resources, it was actually making the problem directly very much worse.
Your own experience with the Nixon administration, you faced a desperate attempt by the Nixon White House to discredit you by, among other things, breaking into the psychiatrist's office that you saw and a whole host of other dirty tricks. Are we seeing a repeat of history in some small way here with the White House damage control machine going into high gear? Are they making fatal errors now in terms of attacking Clark, do you think?
Probably, because they're working hard to attack him, and this crew seems to make at least as many errors as their predecessors ever did. So I think we can assume that they are making errors right now, which may be very costly for them. An exact analogy is their effort to punish, actually, Joseph Wilson, the ambassador who revealed that the White House was deceiving, and that Condi Rice specifically was speaking falsely and saying that they'd had no warning that what they were saying about Iraq seeking uranium from Niger and that they had no indication that it was false, he personally had given them the information that it was false much earlier. In revealing the name of the wife of Joseph Wilson, they were breaking a federal law which protects the identities of clandestine operators. So somebody in the White House, and the indication so far is that it was, in particular, it was Karl Rove in the president's office and other people in the vice president's office, so they broke a federal law. And it may well come out that the administration will begin to unravel significantly in this very election year on the basis of that. If they don't restrain themselves more than they have done so far on Clark, I think we can bet that they will break the law in other ways, or that they will do things that will rebound very severely.
That was Daniel Ellsberg, whose release of the Pentagon Papers in 1971 bolstered opposition to the Vietnam War. Ellsberg's book, Secrets, A Memoir of Vietnam and the Pentagon Papers, is published by Viking Press. Visit his website at www.ellsberg.net. Israel is bracing for retaliatory attacks after Ariel Sharon's government carried out the March 22nd assassination of Sheikh Ahmed Yassin, founder and spiritual leader of the militant Palestinian group Hamas. Replacing the wheelchair-bound Sheikh Yassin as the new leader of Hamas is Dr. Abdel Aziz Rantisi, who has vowed to launch attacks on Israel using all available means, including suicide bombers who target Israeli civilians in their fight to liberate Palestine. For its part, the Israeli government promised to continue assassinating leaders of Hamas and others who engage in violent attacks against Israel. While much of the world denounced the killing of Sheikh Yassin as a dangerous escalation of Israeli-Palestinian violence, the Bush administration withheld judgment and worked to defeat a UN Security Council resolution condemning the murder. Observers noted that the assassination of Sheikh Yassin may have been timed to bolster public support for Ariel Sharon in advance of his government's expected unilateral withdrawal of Israeli troops and settlers from the Gaza Strip and areas of the West Bank. Meanwhile, Mr. Sharon is facing a possible indictment on political corruption charges that could bring down his government. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Phyllis Bennis, a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, who examines the rationale and timing of Sheikh Yassin's assassination and the likely repercussions of the killing, including the possible strengthening of the Sheikh's Hamas movement.
Well, targeted assassinations is murder in clear violation of international law. I think it's right to look at the timing of this attack, which was very carefully timed in relation to a number of events, including some issues having to do with Israel's reliance on U.S. support. Those have to do with the U.S. election campaign. As the campaign heats up, it becomes even more difficult for any presidential candidate to criticize Israel from any quarter. Right now, the Bush administration is on the defensive because of their failures in the war on terrorism. They're significantly even less likely to take a position that might make the administration vulnerable to charges of being soft on terrorism. And third, of course, the U.S. is hunting Osama bin Laden on the same deadly basis of dead or alive that Israel used in going after Sheikh Yassin. Of course, Sharon right now is on the verge of being indicted for a host of fraud-related crimes. Exactly when that's going to happen, we don't know. But by going after Sheikh Yassin, thus shoring up his far-right constituency that might have been waffling a bit, Sharon ensures that he will be able to go forward with his plan for a unilateral pullout of part of Gaza in return for U.S. support for the annexation by Israel of major settlement blocks, which collectively include about 75,000 settlers. So there's a way in which the timing of the assassination is very much key to Sharon's strategic plans.
What about how this assassination plays among Palestinians in terms of the relative strengths of Hamas versus the Palestinian Authority under Yasser Arafat? Might this not, in the short and long term, strengthen Hamas, the more militant, the more violence-prone faction in Palestine?
Absolutely. This is something that is almost guaranteed to make Sheikh Yassin more of a martyr and his organization, Hamas, more of the symbol of Palestinian steadfastness. The timing, again, was not accidental. There were negotiations underway in Gaza between the Palestinian Authority and Hamas and the other militant factions over an arrangement for how to govern Gaza should there be an Israeli pullout from all or most of the Gaza Strip. And it was designed specifically to ensure that there be a unified and peaceful assertion of Palestinian authority in the context of a potentially very chaotic and dangerously violent possibility when there is an abrupt Israeli pullout, if that should occur. Those negotiations now, of course, are completely scrapped. The possibility looms that an Israeli pullout, should there be one, from Gaza will lead to, at least on the short term, a level of chaos and violence that could be very, very bad.
What should U.S. policymakers be concerned with at this moment in terms of the escalation of the conflict between Israelis and Palestinians marked by this assassination of Sheikh Yassin?
Well, I think that one of the things that's going to happen is that when Sharon comes to the United States on April 14th for a White House visit, it has been confirmed that his people in Washington are already negotiating with the U.S. for an agreement that would provide Israel with an important quid pro quo, that if Israel carries out its withdrawal from all or part of the Gaza Strip, that the U.S. would respond by giving Israel approval of permanent annexation of three major settlements in the West Bank that would be made permanent in any future Israeli-Palestinian agreement. Those settlements, Ariel, Gush Etzion, and Ma'ale Adumim, comprised together about almost 75,000 Israeli settlers. All of them, of course, are built illegally on occupied Palestinian land, and all of them include within their prospective borders huge swathes of that land. Now, that issue of U.S. support for annexation was first raised in February when a high-level U.S. delegation travel to the Middle East, and it was announced ahead of time that they would be discussing this issue of annexation. When they returned, there was not a word said. There was no public discussion of the annexation issue, but now we hear that it is indeed being negotiated right now, along with plans by Israel to press the Bush administration to endorse in any future agreement Israel's right to retaliate and perhaps even reoccupy Palestinian lands if Israel believes that there could be future Palestinian attacks, and to guarantee Israel that there would be no Palestinian right of return. So if this is the intention of the Bush administration at the occasion of Sharon's visit on April 14th, in light of this dramatic escalation of the military part of the conflict, I think we're in for a very hot and violent summer in that part of the world.
That was Phyllis Bennis, a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies and author of the book Before and After, U.S. Foreign Policy in the September 11th Crisis. Contact the Institute by calling area code 202-234-9382 or visit their website at www.ips-dc.org. Recent studies have shown that obesity in the United States has reached epidemic proportions. An estimated 65% of all Americans are overweight, a direct cause of diabetes, heart disease, and skyrocketing health care costs. The food industry, which promotes the consumption of junk food high in sugar, fat, and calories, but low on nutrition, has played a primary role in contributing to this health crisis. These powerful corporations target children with advertising campaigns that successfully influence young people to adopt poor eating habits. While healthy foods can be expensive and are often hard to find, junk food is ubiquitous and cheap. High-calorie foods and sugary soft drinks are sold everywhere from gas stations to schools. Researchers say sedentary lifestyles exacerbate the obesity crisis, with television viewing and video game playing often replacing physical exercise. In their book, Food Fight, Kelly Brownell and Catherine Horgan describe the root causes of the obesity epidemic. The authors also discuss public policy initiatives that they say could help reverse America's expanding waistline. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Dr. Brownell, director of Yale University's Center for Eating and Weight Disorders, who describes the food industry's role in the obesity crisis and proposals that would tax junk food and make healthy foods more affordable.
If we're going to have an impact on the prevalence of obesity, we have to start with children. Obesity is a very hard problem to treat once somebody has it. It costs a lot, or the treatments tend not to be very effective. So it screams out for prevention. And of course, if you think prevention, you have to focus on children. Children are completely overwhelmed by an unhealthy food environment, and even the most intrepid parents have trouble competing with it. As an example, the average American child sees 10,000 food advertisements per year just on television, and nearly every one of those is for exactly what you'd expect: sugared cereals, fast food, soft drinks, candy, and the like. And you think of a parent who eats every meal of the year with their child. No parent does, but if you did, and at every one of those meals you delivered a persuasive nutrition message, that would be 1,000 exposures for you over the course of a year compared to 10,000 for the food industry. And you don't have animation, you don't have music, you don't have Disney characters being licensed to help you sell your foods. You don't have those things on your side, so it's very hard for parents to compete. Food is everywhere in our environment. Whereas a high school, maybe at one point when I was a child, might have had one soft drink machine at the most, now we'll have 15. Drug stores have become a place to eat with all the food aisles. So the availability of food is quite unlike it's ever been in the history of our country.
You're famous, or infamous, for promoting what's been called a fat tax. What exactly is your position on food taxes?
The problem with food is that the economics are the reverse of what they need to be. The healthy foods tend to be more expensive, they're hard to get, they're less convenient, they're not very well promoted, and all the opposite is true of the unhealthy choices. So one thing we might try to do is to tip the balance a little bit, and a tax on foods, maybe a small tax, let's say, on something like soft drinks or fast foods, could do several things. Number one is it could be very visible as the nation's way of dealing with obesity. But second, it could generate a tremendous amount of revenue that could be then used for good causes. A tax as small as one penny per can of soft drink nationwide would raise $1.5 billion a year. Now, that's real money. If all that money were used, for example, to pay the leading sports stars or music celebrities to promote healthy foods rather than the unhealthy one, you would really get the attention of the kids of the nation.
You've also talked about food subsidies for low-income families.
What you'd have to do is make sure that the revenue were earmarked for something that would specifically help that population. And one thing might be subsidizing healthy foods to make them cheaper. So if the fast food hamburger started to cost more but the fruits and vegetables cost less, then a family might be able to spend the same amount of money on food but eat healthier as a consequence. Then I think you could justify a tax.
How do you see change happening? Do you think it'll be like the tobacco wars?
I believe this is a set of victories that will be won from the bottom up rather than the top down. The federal government is so friendly to the food industry that it's doing some things, but not nearly what it could. Where the real victories are occurring at the grassroots levels, a school system kicking out the soft drink and snack food machines would be an example of that. Or a state legislator proposing legislation to require calorie labeling on restaurant menus would be another example. And I think, and this is very much like the history with tobacco, by the way, where a lot of the victories occurred at grassroots levels and then spread up to the point where the government just couldn't ignore it anymore, no matter how powerful the tobacco industry was. And I think we're getting to that point with food where the federal government can no longer ignore the bad food environment. They'll have to do things, and it's because of these impressive grassroots victories.
What is the Bush administration doing about this issue?
They finally acknowledge that obesity is a problem. They're bringing attention to the issue. That's a big victory. They're devoting some resources to try to get people more physically active. That's another very good thing to do. But they're not devoting nearly enough to help counteract the huge amount of promotion by the food industry. And the other thing that's so noticeably lacking is that they're not willing to do anything that would damage food sales because the companies are such powerful interests in Washington. So as far as I can tell, the administration's policy on nutrition and obesity is indistinguishable from that of what the food industry would like it to be. And there's basically a script that's played out in both the industry and the administration. And the script says that personal responsibility is the major issue here. Number two, that people have to be more physically active. And number three, if you do anything to change the food supply, you're interfering with choice and freedom. So the administration uses those to advantage, but in the meantime, the population becomes more overweight.
That was Dr. Kelly Brownell, director of Yale University's Center for Eating and Weight Disorders and co-author of the book Food Fight: How America is Eating Itself into a National Health Crisis and What We Can Do About It. For more information, visit the center's website at www.yale.edu/YCEWD. Listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, or would like a recording of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756. Or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Bill Cosentino, Hank Hoffman, Zelfia Hunter, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.